Hello, my name is Isaac Brickman, and welcome to Office Hours. Each episode, I will talk to a professor about a topic that is relevant to you. On each show, the guests will have a different perspective on the topic. The goal is twofold. First, I want to make academia more accessible, applicable, and exciting to everyone, including non-academic audiences. I also want to help dissolve the boundaries between disciplines by taking a more holistic approach to learning. I'm excited to welcome Barone Panetta to our second episode on social media. Barone is a professor of cultural anthropology at Oberlin College in Ohio, who specializes in human rights, indigenous peoples, and Latin America. He is the author of Shipwrecked Identities, Navigating Race on Nicaragua's Mosquito Coast, as well as numerous articles in scholarly journals, including work that deals with the intersections of anthropology, internet governance, and human rights. Welcome to the show, Barone.
Glad to be here, Isaac.
So before I get into culture on social media, I want to start with some background on what culture is by itself. You specialize in cultural anthropology. What is cultural anthropology, and how is that different from other fields of anthropology?
Right. Yeah. Well, anthropologists have, given that it's a term that's at the center of a discipline, you would think that we would have good answers to that question, but we don't really. You know, it's one of these kind of terms that's so general, and we consider ourselves to be, you know, this holistic discipline, which also is this term that's trying to get culture is one of these terms. Holism is another term where it's like, well, let's think about everything. So culture is sort of everything that has to do with how people think about their world, how they, you know, the rules and sort of norms that they are thinking through as they're living their lives. So it's a very general term. But I think for me, the useful part of it, or the part that is sort of helps us to have a path, you know, a research path. What does the anthropologist pay attention to? It has to do with the everyday. You know, we pay attention to sort of everyday life, even stuff that, you know, and so do a lot of social scientists, but even stuff that's hard to count. And so it's kind of that stuff that's hard to count. You know, you can count cultural things, but also there's a lot of things that are hard to count. You know, what are people's sort of feelings and the complexity of their feelings about the rules that they're using to navigate their worlds. And so for me, it's the informal, has to do with the informal and the everyday and the stuff that's hard to count because it's so human, right? It's just, you know, I can ask you on a scale of, you know, 1 to 10, how much do you like, you know, cheeseburgers? And it's like, well, your approach to that's going to be different from somebody else's. And I probably need to talk to you to like think about, you know, your dietary choices and that sort of thing. So anyway, it's the everyday, the informal, that stuff that's hard to measure that has to do with how people think about their world.
Okay, yeah, that's really interesting. So it's sort of what makes us human informally, and it seems like it could get like be a really, really sort of messy field, but that I think can make it fun for sure. Can you talk to me about the cultural relativism versus cultural universalism debate? Because I know that's a big thing in the field of cultural anthropology.
Right. Yeah. So cultural relativism is a term that is also at the center of the field of anthropology. And so the idea is, you know, generally speaking, that each group or society has its own ways of determining what's right and wrong, of deciding what's, you know, the best way to live a life and to organize a society. As opposed to maybe other fields, or certainly in the history of academia, you know, we have this other kind of idea, which is that we find in even in ways that we used to talk about the world in archaeology, where they'd say, okay, the pinnacle of civilization is this idea of civilization, and then there's Stone Age people, and there's people who are behind, and that's really not relativistic at all, right? And it's self-congratulatory because it says what that our whoever our is, usually Western society in some way or another, is the pinnacle. And the way we measure other societies is to say, well, what's the level of their technology? Well, is it Stone Age? Is it Bronze Age? Is it Bronze Age? Etc. And so that obviously is the opposite of relativism, which says that, well, each sort of way of life, each way of organizing society, each sort of level of technology is its own way, and we have to understand it as, on its own terms, as opposed to trying to come up with, I mean, the one that I gave you, is this is hopefully mostly outdated. I mean, but as opposed to that sort of view, which is that there's a single standard and it tends often to be ethnocentric. It's meaning that we use our own way of life as a yardstick to measure other people, and we put ourselves at the pinnacle, right? And so that's the debate, is when it comes to any issue, how much do you take in, how much do you see, a given topic that we're looking at purely in its own terms, or how much do we sort of try to come up with universal frameworks that we can use to judge things? And so, in the most general terms, that's what the debate is about. And then when it comes, I look at human rights, the human rights within the UN, the human rights movement, human rights treaties, and and also human rights approaches to content moderation, to internet governance. And there we see the debate play out in particular ways. So you can have universal standards. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is universal, right? It says that there's a 40-hour work week. Actually, they talk about having paid vacations. Those are like the part that sort of relativists want to make fun of. It's like, who says you have a vacation? That imagines that you work for wages, and not everybody works for wages. The relativist comes around and says, well, let's look at that universalistic language and say, is it pegged to a particular society, a particular life, or is it truly universal, meaning that it can be applied to different contexts?
That's very interesting, and it seems like a very complicated and nuanced debate for sure. I want to turn to culture and social media. What are some of the ways the emergence of social media has impacted culture in the United States specifically?
Impacted culture. Well, I mean, I think when it comes to these issues of ideas that people have about their values, right? And so sometimes we use this fancy kind of social science word meta, so sort of our meta discourse, the way that we talk about having values, as opposed to affirming a value, like I believe in free speech. But then we have these, I think, emergent and really, really conflictive right now debates about what our values are. And so, in this case, in the case of social media, you have the right wing and the left wing right now both talking about how they're champions of free speech, right? And so now we're having this conversation not about free speech in itself, but about each cl laying claim to this idea that we have free speech. And I think social media, has sort of put on the table again in a new way these debates about freedom of expression and free speech, again, where everybody says we are the ones that are truly about free speech, though when obviously we have all sorts of also new things just in recent years happening that seem to be affront to free speech, not letting the AP newswire show up at the White House, not allowing them to enter the White House briefing because they refuse to make the editorial decision to use Gulf of America rather than Gulf of Mexico. That's really a freedom of the press issue that's sort of unprecedented. That all of a sudden a newswire is supposed to adopt the latest change that the White House suddenly wants to make. So anyway, it's a that the one way I could have asked your question, answered your question, is to say, well, there's memes and there's all these kind of cultural trends. But I guess my response to your question was to say, okay, social media also puts on the table this debate that we've been having for forever about freedom of expression.
Yeah, I think it's definitely impacted how Americans view freedom of expression in a meaningful way. Now that we have some sort of general background on social media and culture in the US, I want to turn to sort of a global scale, because obviously culture exists outside of America. And in your 2021 piece, Internet Governance and Human Rights in a Minor Key, you wrote, "It is important to note the tension between illusions of a borderless world fostered by global internet platforms and the realities of cultural borders." And three major cultural issues online are privacy, censorship, and the freedom of speech, which we sort of touched on already. But I want to start with privacy. Since we are not a borderless world, how do other countries approach privacy issues differently than the US does?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, what's really important to think about as, you know, to answer those kinds of questions is you first, I think, have to start off with what are the countries that actually whose governments actually get to have a say on this? Who's so you know, my background is Nicaraguan. So the government of Nicaragua doesn't get to make laws that have any impact on this, right? And I'm well anyway. And so, which countries do, right? So, when we talk about internet platforms and how they are borderless, but they, in terms of who owns them and where they're based, they're not, right? And so, I think to begin to answer that question, I think you have to look at the role of the U.S. government and then the European Union. Right. And so when it comes to free speech, there's very different approaches between the European Union and the US. You know, the US tends to, you know, just recently, you know, speaking of AI, Donald Trump, you know, trying to push through, and the Republicans are trying to push through sort of leave your hands off AI, let it be, we'll figure it out later kind of legislation. And that's very much American in this moment in time, this idea of, on the one hand, you talk about the dangers of the internet, but when it comes to sort of, you're also a party that's all about deregulation, right? And so, but the European Union's been very different. You know, the reason that we now, you know, often when we get online and we get on a website and it says, well, you know, do you want to accept cookies? The reason that happened is because the European Union is trying to push through ideas about free, prior, and informed consent, which is a human rights principle and a governance principle that says when people are you know consuming a service, they should know what they're getting into, right? And so then the European Union made laws about that, and then the so now we in the United States now often say yes, I want to see all cookies or just the ones that are necessary. And so it's interesting the way that works is because that wasn't U.S. legislation that made that happen. That was European Union. European Union legislation, but that's the nature that's, you know, sort of was built into your question, which is this is both global, but then it's their attempts to nationally, or in the case of European Union, you know, supranationally, trying to regulate it. And so, you know, in the old days, you would think, well, a country makes laws and then the people in that country follow it. You know, wear a seatbelt. Well, in the United States, I have to wear a seatbelt. I will. But and I don't pay attention to whether the European Union says I should. But the way the internet works is very different. And so it creates all sorts of interesting and new sort of contradictions and dynamics.
Yeah, I could see why the internet puts a lot of complications in how governments want to approach these issues. And I find it interesting how the US is sort of responding to the EU on issues such as privacy. Clearly, democracies like the US and countries in the EU have their own ways of approaching privacy, censorship, and speech. And so I want to go back to the cultural relativism versus universalism debate. So, since it's difficult to say if there are better versions of privacy, freedom of speech, and censorship in the US versus other democracies. What is the capabilities approach, and how can it help resolve this tension between what the US thinks and what countries, for example, in the EU think?
So I think there's one of the things I want to take away from your question that's really important, gets really to the heart of the issue, is like, okay, which version is better? Like in this case, we're talking about legislation. Like, okay, what should a government do? But when we throw in the cultural question, then we say, okay, which sort of approach to the expectation of privacy that a person might have, a consumer might have, is best, right? Should I be very vigilant? Should I expect that a lot of people, when they talk about internet governance, say, well, the reason that you don't get to exercise your rights, it is because you're on a platform and it's free to you. And so you take your lumps, you take what you can get. You're not even paying for anything. You don't even have consumer rights, right? And so the issue is, one is internet governance. How should it work? What are the best sort of practices? And the other is, to put it crudely, what's the best sort of culture to it? Meaning a citizenry with high expectations, a citizenry that's fatalistic, which is, I don't know, I'm just happy to have this free service and I don't care, right? And what's the relationship? Ideally, in a democratic society, there would be a strong relationship between sort of what people want and expect and what governments are going to do. But I, as a cultural anthropologist who likes to talk about culture, would be naive if I said, well, no, there's a strong relationship between what people's culture is and what laws are put into practice. So that's, I know this is a tough question, so I hope you don't mind me developing this a little, because now that sets me up to talk about the capabilities approach. And so this is part of a philosophy that Amartya Sen and Martha Nussbaum have developed for talking about human rights. And for me, how it starts to address the questions that we're bringing up is that it helps to get past this relativism and universalism debate, because it says, okay, what are your rules in a society? In this case, they were particularly looking at the global human rights rules, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the human rights covenants in the UN. And they say, okay, the relativism debate comes up. Who says that a child should choose their own religion? Because not every society in the world says that a child gets to choose, or any individual gets to choose their own religion. So now we have relativism popping up. And, I think from an American perspective, when you hear that one, you'd say, of course you get to choose your own religion. That should be universal. But not everybody's going to say that, right? There's plenty of societies where you could get in a lot of trouble for denouncing your own religion and saying, well, I'm going to choose this other one, and I'm going to invite missionaries to come in and missionize in my new religion. Anyway, so what the capabilities approach says is, okay, how can we look at what's in the human rights covenants and say, it's not just a matter of an X group of people in 1948 in upstate New York, in a commission led by Eleanor Roosevelt, deciding that these are what is right and wrong, or these are principles for governance and human rights. These are based, these are truly universal, not just arbitrarily chosen, but truly universal, because they're based on human essential capabilities, right? And that's where the capabilities approach is, that human beings need and want, by virtue of being human beings, certain things to be able to have an impact on the world around me and the decisions that are being made, to be able to love, to be able to have children, to be able to be engaged in work that provides you sustenance. And so getting away from thinking about human rights as a laundry list of things that you get to have, and thinking about, if, what does a person have, and what does a person need in a society to be able to serve them such that they can exercise their most fundamental capabilities. And so it's that sort of deeper universalism that I think is what the capabilities approach is. And bringing back to content moderation, I think the opportunity is, or this is not going to, just like all sorts of human rights ideas, they're just, we wish they would just be enacted, and they're not. But the idea is that we could sort of solve some of these debates where, X person says that this is what free speech is. X person says that this is what hate speech is, and say, okay, and then we say, Facebook, you decide. And then Twitter says, no, this is what we decide. And so everybody makes different decisions, and it's a big mess. How could we actually make the most philosophically, deeply reasoned sort of justifications, and that it wouldn't be company by company. It would be done at the sort of the international level using principles like the capabilities approach.
Okay, so in an ideal world, we'd have some kind of capabilities approach that would be applied to all platforms, not just Twitter, not just Facebook, but all of the platforms. I'm curious, do the business models of platforms make the capabilities approach difficult to put into practice by infringing on a user's mental autonomy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so many reasons why it's not a good idea that private companies should be making these calls, and that we accept as a society that they get to make their own calls however they feel like it, and I think that's just a kind of point of departure, that especially because, if you're selling me hamburgers or something, and then it's like, okay, I cannot buy your hamburger, and it's just a consumer choice that I have, and I can shop around. I can get a meatless one. I can get one with low cal. I can get et cetera. I, as a consumer, get to make my choice, and so that's fine. That's fine when the private enterprise gets to make its products, and then the consumer chooses them. But what I think a lot, so many people have been recognizing, and we want the public to understand better, is that the information that we get on our experiences online are more like utilities. They're not like, okay, I'm choosing this hamburger or another hamburger. They're utilities, right? And they're the sort of basic substance of what our democratic societies are going to be built on. And so in that case, we need to think about the way that we regulate utilities, which isn't you get to do whatever you want, right? It's a complex sort of arrangements that need to be made between governments that are, in theory, protecting you and individuals.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up that hamburger example because, social media platforms are a business and a hamburger restaurant's a business, but obviously a social media platform like Facebook or Twitter X is gonna affect human societies in a much deeper and more meaningful way than the hamburger restaurant will. So they definitely need to have sort of different standards applied to them. And I want to go back to your piece for a second. You said also that if human rights principles and institutions are going to be used effectively in content moderation policy, then they must find a way to craft standards that are not so flexible that they are meaningless, while they also must appeal to local concepts that have a particular resonance in their respective contexts. Can you elaborate on what you mean by that quote?
So in that section of the paper, I was talking about the work of Sally Engle-Meri, who recently deceased, unfortunately. And she really worked on struggling with this question that we're talking about, human rights, promotion of human rights, but how can it be done in a way that's not sort of top down, and also not, Eurocentric, or male centric, or how can that be done? And so the idea is that we should sort of embrace that that international idea. She talks a lot about in her work about gender violence, how international ideas about gender violence are and it, that come from the women's movement and so forth are really important, right? And in that case, sort of old culture is bad culture, right? Meaning, you know, there's always just let me, you know, follow this example. So many ways that when we talk about gender violence, there's so many ways that all throughout the world, in the West and outside of the West, gender violence was poo-pooed. It's a private matter. It's not that bad. It's a way that people get along. That's culture. Let's move on. And so the women's movement, you know, when it comes to gender violence, was saying, says, you know, it's wonderful that we have these universal standards that are made as a result of activism and so forth that say we've got to not dismiss this. We've got to take it head on. But in her work, what she talks about is how when these things, when we see how this is dealt with in India, when we see how it's dealt with in Indonesia, and how it's dealt with in Hong Kong, it's important that policymakers in each place take into account the cultural context in which the struggle to do something about gender violence and change culture. Like, you know, I'm an anthropologist who really is not, I'm not promoting culture as it is. No, we have to change culture. But you know, especially in this example of gender violence. And so that's what I mean is that you know, a lot of the people that work in this sphere say one of the important things to make these principles come in be successfully implemented is public education programs about your media rights, about what you can expect and demand of a social media company or an internet provider or of a hardware provider of your phones and so forth. That sort of empowering citizenry to make demands has to happen in a way that takes into account cultural differences and the sort of realities on the ground.
All right, yeah. And the legal scholar Michael Karanikolis, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, gave a theoretical related to your quote that struck me. He said, a racially charged statement in Canada might cause psychological harm, but in Sri Lanka, it might lead to lynchings and communal violence. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I think he might be referring to the role Facebook had in the 2018 anti-Muslim riots in Sri Lanka. Can you tell me a little bit about Facebook's role in these riots?
Right. I'm much more familiar with the case of Myanmar, where there's a Rohingya minority. They are Muslim. The government of Myanmar is a Buddhist government, and the majorities are Buddhist. So it's an ethnic and religious minority in the north. And there's always been, you know, tensions, but at some point, some of the generals and people that were tied to the military started sort of drumming up this hate for Rohingya and fear of Rohingya people, and were publishing all sorts of misinformation that in turn led to riots and, you know, persecution by the majorities and the military against the Rohingya minority, who then crossed the border and they become refugees. Many suffered extreme forms of violence, and so in that moment, Facebook is comes under scrutiny because they said, "Well, look at these lies that and this kind of feeding the flames of hatred that was allowed to happen." And that's in your original example, I think. That's one of the lines that have been used when we're talking about hate speech, or original example of hate speech. So in one place, you know, you can say something bad about an ex minority, and you don't expect this horrible moment that sounds like ethnic cleansing to happen. You just say, oh, the so and so is a really nasty racist, and that's the end of it, right? And so it's like, okay, that's the way it plays out, or that's a reasonable expectation of what will play out in one place, meaning we allow certain kinds of speech to happen, and it's not It's not the crowded, the crowded theater of, that we talk about in legal theory. It's not going to lead directly to action, but in the case of Myanmar, it did. And so then that's the big cultural question is like, how do you have a universal standard about what is hate speech when if part of your standard is, well, you can't say anything that it's going to lead to violence, but you don't know whether in each case what kind of speech will lead to violence and what kind of speech will not. Right. And so that's a really difficult question. And it's the international, it's the cultural question.
Okay. And do you think that if we adapt these global content moderation standards to local context, it might help prevent tragedies like what happened in Myanmar in the future?
I think there's a tough thing here, which is, basic democratic principles are that the more local sort of governance is, the better that it'll be, or at least that there's one sort of vector that says the more local it is, the better it'll be. And that's why we have city councils and we have counties and so forth in the United States and other places, right? So on the one hand, in the case of but there's a problem there. The Myanmarese government was, as it appears, has been very anti-Rohingya, right? And so you could say, well, wouldn't it be better if there was a Facebook sort of division in Myanmar and that they were in charge so that they could pick up on the subtleties of what's going on? But then, of course, what's going on is that there was no accident. Right, meaning that the local people would have sort of at least those ones that are in charge at that moment, at least, were less likely to do anything about it rather than more likely. Even though you could say, well, Facebook is being governed from some other place that they don't understand. It wouldn't be better if it was more local. So that's one sort of tragic contradiction that you have there. And this is actually one reason why some people. And I think very reasonably make the case for having very strong companies like Facebook and X Twitter and is good because they provide sort of another pillar, right? So you have a strong Facebook that the government of Myanmar says, geez, we don't want to piss off Facebook. And then, people are because they can't control Facebook because it's strong. What if every country had its own social media? Right. And we decide, okay, that's the democratic way forward is to say, well, break up Facebook like it was a big monopoly and say, well, each country, go ahead and have your own, and it'll be culturally sensitive because it's based in your own country. And I think a lot of people reasonably say, no, actually, that could be much worse. Right. And so sometimes we say, oh, it's so bad that Facebook is so big and strong, but or any of these big social media companies. But we've got to think about that very carefully. And that's why for me, all this talk about human rights is about international law, right? We've worked on that already, the global community, where we have a place where all of the countries are present and they work on sort of enacting these international covenants, human rights covenants. Unfortunately, human rights law is just a low priority when it comes to so many governments of the world, unfortunately, we don't turn to the UN and the human rights part of it for direction.
So I think we came to an understanding that at minimum, people should be able to have agency when they use platforms, and platforms should not inflame violence. And to do that, we kind of need this combination of the capabilities approach and adapting the moderation standards that are based on the capabilities approach to local context. And particularly with this idea of agency, I think it goes back to my first episode with Professor Ethan Zuckerman, where we talked about how fixing social media requires users to have more control over their online experience. So I think that's really interesting how such a different conversation about content moderation goes back to the whole conversation about how, ultimately, to fix social media, users need to have more control over what they're doing, not platforms and business models of platforms that use algorithms that really sort of inflame misinformation, disinformation, hate speech, etc. But want to finish up with you by shifting away from this heavy topic on social media, and I want to give you my second edition of the Google the Professor quiz. All right.
Okay.
All
Go
right.
ahead.
Nice. So my first question for you is, you wrote a book called Shipwrecked Identities, Navigating Race on Nicaragua's Mosquito Coast. What is Nicaragua's Mosquito Coast?
Yeah. So, Nicaragua's Mosquito Coast is this region of Nicaragua that's very different from the sort of what you might expect of a Latin American country to be like. And so it's a region of ethnic and racial minorities, and that has a history that's very different from the Pacific Coast. And so the people that live there are called Miskito Indians. They're a native people. There's also a lot of people that are called Creoles, English speaking West Indians, people of West Indian background, and then also this sort of Hispanic, Nicaraguans, like the ones that live in the Pacific. And so the book was all about sort of basically race relations and history in that area. But yeah, it's got a really interesting history of where the English were trying to bring the Mosquito Coast into their sphere, and of course the Spanish were defending their claims on the Spanish Main, and so it's got this very interesting history that we don't think too much about in the United States of this sort of English Caribbean being on the English Caribbean being past the islands, but also into the mainland places like Belize and the Atlantic coast of Honduras, Puerto Limon, Costa Rica, the Canal Zone, and Panama. So very much this kind of English Caribbean. So that's what that book is all about.
And why did you choose to write about that location in particular?
Right. Yeah. The way that you come to a dissertation project, I don't know where you are in the process, Isaac, but it can be very circumstantial. So I was at the University of Chicago. This was way back in the 90s, and I had to come up with I was a Latin Americanist for sure, and I was studying with a Caribbeanist. His name was Raymond Smith. And so you come into the fold of your advisors, and so he was getting me to think about theoretical and sort of geographical issues when it came to the Caribbean, and is interested in, and so he got me excited about it. And so I thought, okay, what would be a good place to study this? Speaking of those countries I just mentioned, Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, Belize, and so and then I chose Nicaragua. And also my family, I have a family, and my mother's from Nicaragua, my father's from Costa Rica, so I thought, oh, this will be good. I can sort of go there and live in a way that I wouldn't have been able to otherwise.
Interesting. Okay, on to the second question. You will teach a course in the fall with the code ANTH241. What is the name of that class?
Yeah, it's called Digital Worlds, the Anthropology of the Internet.
Correct.
I was hoping I wouldn't get it wrong. Yeah, but that's the title.
Can you tell me a little bit about that class?
Yeah, so it's what it's exactly about what we've been talking about. I put sort of all of this stuff, that's coming straight out of the headlines. And try to work with my students, teach them ways to think through these issues of privacy and governance, and also think about doing anthropological research on the internet, which itself is a little bit tricky. I mentioned before a little bit of qu the quantitative versus qualitative, that we anthropologists really focus on the stuff that's hard to count. And so one of the challenges with studying the internet as an anthropologist, our famous method, or our signature method, is we call participant observation. You do what other people are doing. Remember, we're not trying to count anything. We're not getting databases. And so you do what other people are doing. You go to some place where you want to study and you live with people, and you don't maybe even have your notebook up. And so, well, how do you do that when it comes to the internet? Like, there's a chat room, or there's a, there's a Discord server, or, people are playing video games. How do you sort of get on the ground? And or do you just give up and say, well, that's not the nature of it anyway? So that class, from a methodological point of view, beyond this sort of substantive issues of the controversies and so forth, is how, how to use the best practice, our key methods. So this is not a general class, it's really an anthropology class. How do we use our methods to study the internet? And yeah, I've been doing that. I've done it about four times now, because this my, as you mentioned in my introduction, my book from before was all about Nicaragua. We were just talking about Nicaragua, and it wasn't about the internet. And so, in the last about 7 or 8 years, I've been working on internet issues, and so in the last four or so, I do a class about it.
Nice. I find that to be such a interesting intersection. I'm glad you're studying it because I haven't heard a lot of people study that. I wish they offered that course at my alma mater, UMass. I definitely would have taken it. For my final question, you teach at Oberlin College, which is a small school in Ohio. What is your favorite thing about Oberlin College?
Right. My favorite thing. I guess I really appreciate people's willingness to not think about how practical each assignment might be, each class, their major, the 4 years here. I appreciate that, especially as an anthropologist. I had, before I went to Oberlin, I was working at another school. And I was frustrated with the teaching sometimes, because I felt that the students weren't necessarily glad to be in their seats from the get-go, just to be learning, to be reading, and that they were, their thinking was clouded by a very understandable pressure of, like, how's this going to help me in my job, or get a job, or, and so I come to Oberlin College, and I really try very hard that convince students that being in their seats and having the discussions we're having is going to help them. So it's not like I dismiss the issue, but I really am glad that there's no panic, at least in the moment, about it, or even resistance. Even panic is probably the wrong word. Resistance to, like, okay, what am I doing here? Why am I going to learn anthropology? What's the practical value of this? And so anyway, I guess it's that open-mindedness. What I don't like, though, a little bit, is the, sometimes I think, and we're seeing this now as the, government of the United States is going after higher education in general for what they say is this kind of liberal bias. I sometimes, I have no agreement with that position, but Oberlin is a place where sometimes people's minds aren't open, and as they should be, or at least the cool kids are cool because their positions are represent an extreme that's something that I try to work against sometimes, even though I appreciate, in theory, the sort of openness.
That's a very good answer. You're reminding me a lot about the other students at my school and who the cool kids were. But anyway, thank you so much for taking the time to join my podcast. I know it's only the second episode, so you took a leap of faith to come on here and take the time. So I really, really do appreciate having you on, and I thought we had a great conversation.
Well, I do too, Isaac. I really appreciate the invitation, and good luck with the podcast. And now, I got to subscribe now, and I want to see who you'll have on in the subsequent episodes.
All right, great. Thank you.